Tales O' Mine. I haven't shared a book that I've read lately, so I'll pass on a mystery series by an Italian author, Maurizio Di Giovanni. His police detective's perspective is a little different than most. He can hear the deceased's last thought. The reader is also privy to each character's thoughts, various mental camera angles, if you will. You know how sometimes you can easily imagine someone acting out a book's character on the screen? Well, in the series' current book, Everyone in Their Place, the officer that usually assists in the detective's crime-solving ventures is on a diet. Every time someone eats anything, he's furious, taking it personally. It's pretty funny. No actor in particular comes to mind, but I can visualize how an actor could have a lot of fun with it. Anyway, I would definitely recommend the Commissario Ricciardi books by Di Giovanni. Remember when, as each season ended, you'd stash those clothes away and switch them out for the current season? Seasons seem to be moving later or overlapping into the next one longer. Crazy. I was wearing sandals a couple of days ago, and now the weather has switched again, and it's back to socks and closed-toe shoes for the next week. When I pulled the sandals out, I was thinking about how popular rhinestones and other crafty glued-on pieces have become. When I was in high school, those were considered garish and tacky. Fashions weave in and out, bob back and forth, take the old and update as new. Some trends only make one appearance, however, such as paper dresses. Yes, paper dresses. The idea, of course, was that you wouldn't have to wash them, just toss them. Very non-environmentally friendly. Probably why they haven't made a comeback. There is a photo somewhere of my mother and I wearing matching silver paper dresses for Christmas. Other vintage clothing has actually become trendy. Consignment and thrift stores have a pretty steady clientele of creative fashionistas. The Center for Sacramento History is a research and archive facility. It's holding a tour this weekend of their shoe collection, which dates back to the 1860s, including miner's boots, Victorian high-top boots, bombshell stilettos, and Charleston dance shoes. I sat down with the center's curator of history, Veronica Candle, and its photographs archivist, Rebecca Crowther, about the exhibit, shoe history, and the best methods to preserve shoes and other types of clothing.
On Easter, one of my cousins were just a few days apart, and she had shared an Easter picture on Facebook, and she was wearing go-go boots, and I started laughing because I had the same clothes.
Oh, I love it.
So I was thinking with the show, I bet a lot of people are going to be cruising through and going, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, Dad had that. Oh, remember when Mom?
Absolutely.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that usually happens when people look at museum collection storage anyway, but I think even more so with clothing. I mean, when you said, it's funny, when you said Easter, I was thinking clothing, and I still remember as a little kid, I got this bright yellow coat for Easter. I think because you can relate to those kind of things so much and there's things you love. Yeah, I think there's a lot that people can relate to.
Especially if a beloved family member had a certain pair of shoes or coat, what have you, then you see that and you immediately think of them. Good, bad, or ugly. You have a memory with it.
And also, we have collections or items in our collection that go up to the 1970s. So it's not like it's so distantly removed that people don't either remember it or remember someone, you know, in their family wearing those things. We certainly do have ones that go back to 1860, but, you know, a lot of them are from the time period that people will remember. So I think that's also an added thing. You know, like you said, you can go, oop, there's those platforms I wore and broke my ankle on.
Probably helps, too, genealogy being interesting to so many people now, trying to figure out where they came from and maybe having a photograph and not being able to place a time. Might get a few of those people coming through, too. Or do you have that on a regular basis? Quasi-regular basis?
Yeah, we certainly do get people that come in and you know, ask for those types of things that jog people's memories. Say, oh, yeah, I do have a photo like that. But, yeah, I mean, every once in a while that certainly happens. And, you know, you try to look at the clothing. Clothing and cars are great ways to date things.
Absolutely.
Not that I know cars, but, you know.
So this is focusing on shoes, though.
Yes, it is. Footwear.
So it would be interesting to me generally to see the different type of textures, different type of materials, mm-hmm. I guess I should say, that were utilized mm-hmm. throughout the years, what was available, and
yep, exactly.
times during war,
yep,
when you had very
sure.
limited mm-hmm. resources. So what have you learned
yep.
from men's and women's?
Our collection really is very heavy on women's footwear, probably from the mid-20th century. Unfortunately, our holdings in the men's footwear is not as big as I would like to see, so a lot of our information is focused on women's. It is interesting, and when you said that, that certainly you can see the changes in the type of material that were used for footwear. Really, even back in the 1860s up to about 1920, the majority of your materials were leather, kid, or fabric, some type of fabric shoe. Your colors for your leather and kid were limited also, because of the type of dyes that are available. As you start developing aniline dyes and synthetic dyes, you get larger dye colors, but you certainly are pretty limited to the amount of colors that you use. And then, like you said, it's interesting, during the wartime, I didn't realize how many restrictions there were on the shoe industry, especially during World War II, because of the leather and dyes, and even the amount that people were rationed. You could only buy 3 pairs of shoes a year during World War II. It's like, 3 pairs of shoes? How can you survive on 3 pairs of shoes? Now, at that point in time, women had on an average only 5 pairs of shoes. So buying 3 a year, I guess, to them wasn't too bad. But there were restrictions on the amount of material you could use. They were restricted to dye colors, 5 dye colors. So World War II brought in a lot of restrictions. But then what happened is because of all the technology that was developed during World War II and all the, you know, synthetics that came about after World War II, you see an explosion of materials. During the war, a lot of designers used a lot of natural materials, hemp and cork and raffia. You know, they were trying to use things that they could and get around the rationing. But then after the restrictions were taken off in the 50s, you get vinyls and plastics and acrylic, you know, just all these different types and colors of material. And we have the women's shoes laid out on a table kind of by decade. And if you stand at one end and you just look down, you look and you see how the beginning colors got black and white and brown. And then you get a little bit more color and some metallics come in because you could dye leather, gold or silver. So you get a little bit. And then you get some fabrics in there, some brocades and things. And then as you get into the 50s and 60s, the colors just explode. So it's very interesting to see that.
It's like going from black and white to technicolor.
In a way it is, yeah.
When you were talking about limitation of shoes, my great aunt had told me it was frustrating for her because she had 3 boys who were outgrowing their shoes and there's nothing she could do about it.
Yeah.
So you got the kids' shoes aspect thrown in there as well.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. Again, because our collection focuses so much on women's, focus has been on women's wear and not children's and men's so much. That's interesting when you talk about, now that I think about 3 pairs of shoes for a kid probably is not a lot a year, you know. I mean, a child could probably grow out of a pair of shoes and 3 pairs in a year. So.
And also the size of feet. You know, women had tiny feet.
Actually, one of the stop labels we have, we compare 2 shoes. And the fact that the average size of women's feet went from about a 3.5 in 1900 to now they're about 8.5. It's amazing the change that it's like the size and the height of people, better nutrition, better health care. People have been able to grow bigger and subsequently their feet grow bigger. What I think is really interesting too is not just the length, but the width. You know, when you look at the early shoes, they're just narrow and small.
Even the 40s, I attended a big band event, and so we wanted to dress appropriately mm-hmm. with actual 1940s, and I could not find any shoes that fit me. They were all, even in the 40s, they were very tiny.
Well, I think that part of that has to do with, it also has a tendency to skew what is left has a tendency to skew our perception, I think. Because actually the pair, one of the pairs of shoes I have out there that's doing a comparison is from the 40s. And I could wear those. I wear size 9s. And I could have worn those shoes. And I think what happens is that...
I should amend that. I did see larger shoes, but they were ugly.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to... I mean, that's what I was going to say in a way. Things you have a tendency to keep are things that are more special occasion. This happens with clothing collections, so footwear, you know, dresses, things like that. Usually what's kept are wedding dresses and evening dresses or something that has a particular event connected to it. And so therefore, they're usually more kind of fashionable, dressy type of things. And I think that smaller, younger, this is my bias, smaller, younger women have a tendency to keep those things and they're more fashionable. Older women who may be a little larger probably don't keep that kind of stuff as much. That's something that's always kind of intrigued me, and I would love to spend a lot of time doing that, but I've noticed that in different collections that I've looked at, there's this tendency for all of them to be teeny and tiny, but I'm like, I've looked at also a record from a seamstress, and I looked at the measurements, and some of the people's measurements are not that, from 1900, are not that off from what they are today. So I think it has a tendency to be with what's held, what's kept, and what's given to places, or what's available. I think that there's a whole combination of things going on there.
Utilitarian stuff gets worn to bits, and is not saved.
Yeah, because the size 9 shoes that I have out there, they're ugly. They're utilitarian. They're kind of ugly. You're right. So often, and it's surprising that those are kept. We have a fair amount of pretty sturdy utilitarian shoes in the collection, which I find very interesting.
Including mining boots, apparently?
Yeah, we have a pair of mining boots. They're pretty cool. They're this really, really, really thick leather that I believe is called kip. I haven't learned that much about it, but they basically come up, the whole boot itself comes up to about your knee, and then there's this shield that goes over the knee. So it's kind of a flap, protect your knee. The soles have spikes in them, keep from sliding around in all the wet soil and rocks and things
damp
like that.
Ground, yeah. That makes sense. I wouldn't have thought about that.
Yeah.
Spiked mining boots. Interesting.
Yeah. And what's cool is that we found a 1900 catalog from Weinstock in Lubin. They advertise a pair of miners boots that looks almost identical to the pair we have. So that's kind of fun.
So have you cut out a visual of that?
Yes. Yeah, we have a copy of the page from Weinstock and Lubin.
Nice.
With a big arrow pointing to the...
I guess it wasn't clear.
Yeah.
How many kids' shoes do you have?
In the collection, we only have about, I want to say, maybe 50 pairs. A total collection of footwear is about 300 pieces, and over more than half is women's. Most of the children's shoes that we have are booties, like little knit booties and things like that, more so than actual hard shoes, you know. They're little infants. Yeah. Little infants kind of knitted, a lot of little knitted booties and things like that.
So how's this collection been amassed? How have the donations come to your attention?
We're celebrating our 60th anniversary this year. So
congratulations.
We've been collecting for 60 years, basically. The majority of items, both three-dimensional and our archival items. Rebecca's our photo archivist, and so she can speak a lot better on our photos than I can. I deal much more with our three-dimensional items. Are primarily donated to us by either individuals, businesses, community organizations. We are the official repository for the records of the city, county of Sacramento, and the Superior Court. So we basically required to keep those. So that's really how we get the majority of our items, is donations. Every once in a while, if we see something that is really significant and connected to Sacramento, we tried to find the funds to purchase something. There was a 1860s daguerreotype of a
Turnverein member.
Okay, member
August Klein,
who was a member of the Turnverein here, which is a German social athletic club. The German immigrants brought that from Germany, and they would set up these kind of clubs and towns that they settled in, and place for them to go and participate in athletics and social things, and it's called a Turnverein. One of our staff members saw a daguerreotype of this gentleman, August Klein, that was for sale in Germany, and it was him in his Sacramento, well, the picture was taken in Sacramento when he was a member of the Sacramento Turnverein. So we purchased that because of the connection, and we had information about him.
Nice. People ask me, why are you interested in old stuff? And I said, because they all have stories. And with clothing, obviously, people wore them, walked in them, so the stories are even more intense and expanded.
Absolutely.
And I shouldn't assume, but I'm assuming that some of the clothing came with stories?
Some of it did. I would have loved it if more pieces did. Because, as I said, things usually for special occasions, or even not, you know, what happens with clothing a lot, especially since people weren't as mobile as they are now. People also reuse their clothes a lot more than they do now. They would refashion them. Women would take their dresses and they would restyle them so that they fit the style of the day. And then when it finally got to the point, they would probably put something in a trunk or a box and put it up in the attic. And it would sit there for sometimes generations. And then usually what happens is people go up there and they find this box that's been sitting there and they open it up and go, oh, this must belong to my grandmother. And there's usually not information with it unless someone has specifically put that information. But what happens usually is the information just gets lost because those are the things that just have been around for a while. You're lucky if someone said, oh, yeah, this was worn by grandmother to her wedding. Now, I found instances where you get things and it says, this was worn by so-and-so in 1870 for their wedding. And then I look at the mark on the shoe and I look up the manufacturer and I look at the business and find that those didn't come into existence until 1890 or 1900. So you know that that story is not correct. But yeah, some of the stories are really fun. I guess what I'm saying is I wish more people would get the stories and put them with their clothing.
As a biographer, I concur.
Because it is frustrating, you know. It's like, I'd love to know where this is. I'd like to know why this was worn or why this was saved. But yeah, so often what we get is people to come in and here's a box of clothing and I know it's been in the family or I know it belonged to my aunt. But they might not have specific stories. So we have a few that are kind of fun. We have the ball gown that Mrs. Mary Stoneman wore to the inaugural ball of her husband, George Stoneman, when he was inaugurated as the 15th governor of California. So we have her gown and two pairs of shoes that she wore, one to the ball and one to the inauguration. And then the story of the Stonemans is actually kind of fun. It's almost like a little soap opera.
Share, dish.
Yeah. Okay. I couldn't find much about her until she married Stoneman. She was born in, I want to say, Washington, D.C., but her family is very Southern, and so she married a Yankee. The family didn't care much for that. They lived in Baltimore. So even though the family lived in Baltimore, they still considered themselves Southern. But she married him anyway. But the only information other than that is that she was a good dancer. I like that. She was very social and good dancer. After George, who was a general in the Civil War, he had problems during the Civil War because he was in the cavalry and he developed a very bad case of hemorrhoid. And
not good on a horse.
No. So he had a lot of medical issues during the war and a lot of problems with like his command because he had been gone a lot and things like that. So he kind of, at the end of the war, kind of like got out of the military. And they bought a ranch in the San Joaquin Valley. He got involved in politics then when he was living down there. So he becomes governor in 1883. And of course, they're living up here in Sacramento. And at that time when they're living up here, the ranch in the valley burns. Well, Mary didn't know that George either forgot to or just ignored keeping up the insurance on the ranch.
Uh-oh.
So the ranch burns down. They can't build it because there's no money. And evidently, George was not good with money either, and so there was no money to rebuild the ranch. So she was not a happy camper.
No dancing then.
No. And then there were stories of affairs, and I still haven't been able to figure out who had the affair, if it was she or he. But basically what happened is that then they split up after that, and basically never divorced, but died being separated. We also have a pair of spiked track shoes that were worn by a Sacramentum. His name was Jack Mauger, and he was a track star. He started running track in high school and then became a pole vaulter at Grand Rapids City College, was then called Junior College. It was back in the 1930s. He went then to Berkeley and set a record for pole vaulting, came back, and he also ran with Jesse Owens. He then came back to Sacramento and became the track and field coach for McClatchy High School, which had just opened that year. And so we have his running shoes. We have one of his jerseys with the C from, we just found out that's from Berkeley, when he was during his Berkeley years, and a portion of one of his poles for pole vaulting. So that's a nice little Sacramento story.
So you've probably covered all the decades pretty well. There must be some that you have to say, I'm sorry, we already have that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The majority of what we have is probably from the 19-teens through the 70s. One of the things I'd like to do is start collecting things from the 80s, 90s, and today, you know. And there's a few things, a few classic things that we don't have. We don't have any Doc Martens, and we don't have any Nikes. Some of these kind of classic pieces that you think of from a particular time period. So I'd like to... And the other thing that I think people don't realize is that we don't have a lot of the quote-unquote designer shoes. When you talk about certain decades, there's certain designers that pop up, and when you talk about the 30s and 40s with platforms, Ferragamo is always in the name that comes up because he's the one that quote-unquote developed the platform in the 30s. You know, we don't have any shoes by Ferragamo. What we have are shoes that were bought by Sacramentans, you know, so most Sacramento people are not going to be out buying designer shoes at that time period. Ours are pieces that were worn by people in the area. So you get kind of a middle, I must admit, kind of a middle class reflects the area.
Yeah, Sacramento was never really on the fast track.
No. No.
What was the catalyst for this event?
We collect to preserve the history and also help people to see the history of the Sacramento region. And because we're rather limited in this space, this is mainly a research facility and storage facility. We mainly use our three-dimensional artifacts and our photo collections at the History Museum in Old Sac. We're basically the collecting venue for that exhibition facility. But we also wanted people to become more aware of what it is that we have here at this facility. And one of the ways we thought we'd do that is by bringing out certain parts of the collection annually and highlighting them and letting people take tours through our storage vault, let them see what we do here, and then highlight collections. Last year we highlighted hats.
And top to bottom.
Yeah, this year it's footwear. To be able to see more of what we have. Because it's tough, you know, when people say, well, you collect all this stuff, what do you do with it? And with archives, especially photos, our photos and our archival items are used so much more than our three-dimensional items for research, genealogy. You get requests.
Documentary films, book projects, office displays, you name it. People are looking at the photographs for all sorts of reasons. And because of their size, etc., they're easier for researchers to work with as opposed to something like a gown or shoes. It's not really something that we could actually bring out to a researcher for them to look at in our research room. So this is an opportunity for them to come in and actually experience these collections.
How do you storage your textiles?
Access to how most museums utilize their collections. You like to try to store them by the same type of thing. So you like to try to store all your footwear together. You utilize different type of storage facilities based on what the type of material it is. You could use acid-free storage boxes. You can use powder-coated metal cabinets. You can use some different types of woods if they're sealed and then they have a barrier coat on them. Some things get stuffed with acid-free tissue. If they're strong enough, say dress, if it's strong enough, you can hang it on a padded hanger. So there are different techniques depending on what the piece is.
Because I was thinking if someone has grandma's party dress from 1924, they want to make sure they're storing it correctly.
Yeah, we get a lot of requests for that. Basically, I always kind of hate when people call and ask me what do I do with quilt or my dress because I want to display it. And I'm like, you know, the best thing to do is to hide it away from everywhere and put it in a dark closet. Because again, lights and heat are the worst.
But at the same time,
right.
You want
to
share it because
so
it's someone who
my reaction is always like, well, you know, the best thing to do is to, like with a quilt, lay it on a bed and try to keep the room as dark as possible when you're not in there. Try to put it in a bedroom where you always have the shades closed unless you go in there. If you want to, say, hang something in a shadow box, make sure you use archival mat board or any type of board inside. Get AV filtering glass over the top of the case. Hang it somewhere where, again, you're not going to have sunlight getting on it. Because those are the things that affect it. For wedding dresses, don't get that blue tissue paper. I don't even know if they still do that anymore. But don't get the boxes that have the little plastic hole in the top because, you know, sunlight's going to get in right in there and then you're going to light and you're going to have this one spot right here. Make sure it's acid-free. Acid-free boxes can get expensive, so the other thing I tell a lot of people is, you know, actually a clean white sheet that's been washed with no starch and wrap it up in that. And then every 6 months or so, wash the sheet and cover it up again.
That's simple enough.
Yeah. It's inexpensive. It's simple. Try not to hang it if you've got too much weight on the shoulders. In that case, if it is, lay it down flat. And again, you can lay it flat on in a closet or whatever, but don't let it come in contact with wood. Get some acid-free mat board. Lay that down first on the wood and then lay down your piece. And you can see when it turns yellow, change the board.
Now, do you ladies have anything in your family that...
Oh, I have my grandmother's wedding dress, and I have my mother's wedding dress. And
I have some of my dad's childhood clothing, and some things from my grandfather, too.
Wow.
They were sort of into Western wear, so I have a lot of Western bow ties.
Okay.
Actually, some of my dad's from when he was a kid in, I think, probably second grade. He was photographed wearing one of those for his class picture, and I actually have his little Western bow tie still.
Oh,
yeah.
I love it. Do you have any cowboy boots? Did he have cowboy boots?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's so sweet.
Absolutely.
That's cute. You have pictures of him in it, too. Great. That's fun. That's always nice when you can see people in the outfit.
I'm imagining that there's probably clothing that you may have in your, or maybe not, that were hand-sewn from as opposed to machine.
Oh, we have a lot that was hand-sewn. Women's mass-produced clothing, really, to go to the quote-unquote department store and buy something off the rack, really did not for women develop until the 20s. Now, you could buy outerwear at, like, department stores. It would because of the fact that until that time period, you pretty much had to fit everything to every person. I guess I should say that more inexpensive work kind of clothes you could buy. You go to Sears and buy it through the catalog. But when you think about dresses that were evening dresses and even some day dresses, the way they fit, you had to fit it to the person. So either you had a dressmaker make it or you made it to fit. And you could not have mass production techniques making all those different sizes. It wasn't until you got more standardized sizes. And one of the things about the 20s is that you basically had a tubular shape. You didn't have a lot of ins and outs. So you could mass produce that stuff because you had more standardized sizes. So you started standardizing your sizes. So you definitely, the collections, the majority of them are going to be handmade. Now there's a difference too. People always say handmade. There's machine sewn at home by hand and there's machine sewn made in a factory. And then there's hand sewn. Now most people that we have, what we have is not going to be hand sewn because by the time 1850s, is when Singer developed the sewing machine, and he's the first one that basically kind of started the whole credit thing. You buy the machine and you can pay for it over time. So by the time Sacramento was pretty established, the sewing machine was pretty well being utilized by most people. Go to the East Coast and you're going to find hand-sewn clothing because it was before, a lot of it's before that
immigrants arrived there before they did here.
Oh, well, yeah. How long they've been in the East Coast. So the majority of things you're going to find here are probably handmade machines. Stitch. A lot of people reused their clothing and remade it. So you will find fabric and sometimes like your bodice will have been an older bodice and then they'll make a new skirt out of the old material. And so you can see signs of hand sewing that way.
In the 70s, in fact, I was in high school and it was a fad where you would cut off the lower part of the jean, the knee down, and replace it with the bottom of another pair of pants. Like cords?
I vaguely remember. I remember...
Like build your own bell bottom?
See, I remember that. Making a gusset, cutting up the side seam,
pointy.
And then sticking sticking the stuff in between.
Yeah, and you put a little band around
it.
I forgot about that. Yeah. My uncle found this old box of my great aunt's photographs, and there's one of my cousin and I, and I'm wearing... I said, oh my God, that was... Because the lower half... was my cousin Daryl's, because we were up at camp, this old logging camp, and it was hot, so he'd cut off his pants because he just wanted shorts, and I had a crush on him. So the bottom half were
shorts. Yeah, I remember doing that, too.
That would be kind of funny to have to your collection if you could get a hold of one of those.
I would love to find a pair of those.
So let's put a call
like
out.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, the other thing we don't have, kind of surprises me, is we don't have a lot of hippie stuff, like no fringe suede vests or, stuff like that. Sometimes those are the kinds of things, those kind of iconic. We did get a pair of go-go boots, so I'm very happy about that.
I'm sure that Sacramento is not the only city or town where many of its residents are unaware of historical items available to them for viewing, researching, or educating. The Center for Sacramento History has hit upon a creative idea that other cities might follow. In addition to the vintage shoe tour exhibit, they are simultaneously hosting a vintage fashion fair, where a number of vendors will be offering up vintage clothing for sale. Visit centerforsacramentohistory.org for more information. In my ongoing celebration of the 150th anniversary of the National Park System, this week I'm heading over to North Dakota to Theodore Roosevelt National Park, which encompasses three geographically separate areas of Badlands. Initially established in 1947 as Theodore Roosevelt National Memorial Park, the name was changed in 1978 when it became an actual national park. It's important that we highlight Mr. Roosevelt because he not only signed legislation establishing five national parks, Crater Lake, Wind Cave, Sully's Hill, North Dakota, later redesignated a game preserve, Mesa Verde, and Platte, now part of Chickasaw National Recreation Area. But he also enacted the Antiquities Act of June 8, 1906. I make a point of not incorporating politics into my podcast, but the passage of H.R. 1459 weakening the Antiquities Act by making the president jump through hoops to designate land as national parks is deplorable. Now keep in mind that national monuments are not the same as national parks. A national monument is intended to preserve at least one nationally significant resource. A national park is usually larger and preserves a variety of nationally significantly large resources. For example, in one of my previous podcasts, I highlighted Acadia National Park. Originally, Sieur de Monts was established as a national monument in 1916, and a decade later became Acadia National Park. To quote Roosevelt when he was visiting the Grand Canyon, "Leave it as it is. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it." North Dakota was first visited by Roosevelt in 1883 to hunt bison. He fell in love with the area, investing money in the Maltese Cross Ranch and starting a second ranch, Elkhorn. His pursuit of conservation policies were influenced by his time spent in the area. The park encompasses over 70,466 acres, which includes 29,920 acres of wilderness, one of the few islands of designated wilderness in the northern Great Plains. It is also home to one of the largest deposits of petrified wood in the country. This is beautiful country, regardless of time of year. If you're looking for a volunteer vacation in North Dakota, there's an upcoming opportunity in Cheyenne Nation Grassland, July 13th through the 19th. Visit AmericanHiking.org. Since it's National Poetry Month, here's a poem my grandfather wrote to my grandmother in 1927 while he was serving in the Navy and they were still dating. "I think about you often, and I'd write you every day, but there's so very little that seems worthwhile to say. It either rains or it doesn't rain. It's either hot or cold. There isn't any news to tell, or else it's all been told. The only thing that matters is the fact that you are there and I am here without you. And it's lonesome everywhere. I think about the way you smile and I recall your touch. The distance lends enchantment and I miss you very much." Do something different. Hold a paper airplane contest.